I faced a moral conundrum at work a while back while standing in front of the pop machine in our break room one weekday afternoon. Now, I know there might be some health purists among us who would argue that, you know, the act of standing in front of a pop machine by itself is evidence of a moral failing. And, you know, let's try to set that issue aside for a moment. This particular pop machine had one quirky, some might say delightful, feature. Upon depositing your money and pressing the button, the drink you selected would be delivered as it was supposed to be. However, if you quickly follow your first press and your timing was just right and you hit the button again, there was about a 50% chance that you would be rewarded with a second one, gratis. Throughout the day, I'd hear my fellow employees, my cube was just, you know, somewhat close to the break room, and I'd hear them making their way to the break room with some anticipation. One might display, you know, entering a Vegas casino if you did that kind of thing. And it wasn't uncommon for me to hear exclamations of sweet or bonus emanating from behind the break room door as they got their second gratis pop from the machine. Well, this machine did offer a little excitement, of course, a little diversion during the otherwise humdrum workday. For me, it presented somewhat of a spiritual dilemma. It's that dilemma I found myself contemplating as I stood before it with my finger kind of poised on that button. Do I do the second quick press, or do I not? Would pressing it a second time with full knowledge of what might occur if I press that button a second time, constitute a clear breaking of God's command not to steal? Or is it really just too trivial to even think in those terms? Maybe even pharisaical, for that matter. Turn, if you would, over to Luke 16, because I think here's a passage that speaks to the dilemma that I was facing as I stood in front of that pop machine that afternoon. Here in Luke 16, verse 10, we read, Luke 16, verse 10 says, "He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much." Unfortunately, the verse that here in Luke 16 didn't pop to my mind the moment I was standing with my finger poised to push that button. And so I did, and yes, I was one of the 50% who were rewarded. And I have to admit, yes, I think the word yes did come out of my lips. And I have to admit, I'd be lying if I didn't return to that same pop machine and attempt several times to repeat the same reward. But given the fact that I'm, you know, actually up here telling you about this, I think it's pretty obvious. It speaks to the fact that even though it in some ways was trivial, I knew that I was making the wrong choice. I knew it. I knew on some level, even in a small way, that I was being unfaithful to God in that little decision. I want to talk a few minutes about our faithfulness in the small areas of life. Now, when I shared with someone here last week that I was preparing this message for today, they said, "Oh, hey, Mike Pischke, he talked about that just last week." Sudden angst kind of swelled up inside, and I went home, and that week I listened to his message, a very fine sermonette on a very similar topic, and decided whether I would ditch this one or not. But I'm coming at this hopefully from a little different angle, so I decided not to ditch it. So if you heard that sermonette, you already have been reminded about the consequences, sometimes very large consequences, of taking or not taking small actions. You know that small things do matter. It matters to a pilot making small adjustments or miscalculations in flight. It happens when scientists are planning a mission in space. Small does matter. Small mistakes, small decisions can have huge implications. And most of us in our world today would acknowledge that. Obviously, we don't want somebody who doesn't care about minutia to be flying our plane. We don't want a surgeon who doesn't care about detail, the small things operating on us. I think we get that. But in the realm of the moral, too often, too many in this world don't seem to know that, don't seem to consider the small things. In fact, if I were to share this moral dilemma that I was having while standing in front of the pop machine, my coworkers probably would have laughed me to scorn. You're kidding, really? Right? Why would you think that way? Well, 1 Peter 5:8 tells us, I won't ask you to turn there, but we know Satan, our enemy, he roams about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So his goal, his desire is to destroy us spiritually, and he'll do it any way he can. And one way he goes about doing that is by deceiving us in this matter, deceiving with us in the matter of faithfulness or unfaithfulness to God. And the way he does this is often subtle. He doesn't attack us in the black and white, does he? He doesn't always attack in the large moral areas of right and wrong. Sometimes he does, but not often. And I would say not most of the time. Most of us don't wake up in the morning and say, I think I'm going to go steal something today. And if we do say that, then there's probably a larger issue we need to deal with. But most of us don't go there. Most of us don't have those thoughts. Our struggles with sin are in choices we make in smaller things. Turn, if you would, over to James 2. James 2. Satan knows that we are vulnerable in the small areas, that we're less likely to be vulnerable to the larger areas of obvious sin. And so that's how he operates. Instead, he focuses his attention. He seeks to lull us into complacency in the small areas, in gray areas, areas that are often hidden, areas that are often overlooked by many, areas of compromise, small, almost trivial indiscretions, things that are often maybe winked at by this world and dismissed as, you know, this is no big deal. What's the problem with that? Everybody does that. That's why I think what we read here in James 2 is should be sobering to all of us who would walk this walk. It's a wake-up call, I think, for you and I to be on guard against our enemy who tries to use the small to undermine us, to undermine our faith. Let's begin reading here in James 2, verse 8. If you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he's guilty of all. Now, I don't know if you're like me at all, but I've always read this, and I put this scripture in the context of obvious sin. You know, I kind of compare the obvious sins to one another in the hierarchy, you know, the levels. Well, you know, if you lie, right? If you lie purposely, it's a sin just as much as committing adultery as coveting. They're all on the same par. They're all on the same level. You can't draw a distinction. Lying is the same in a spiritual sense as murder. There's a gap there between the two, but in God's eyes, that both of them make us guilty of all. Both of them earn us the death penalty. But if you really look at the context of this passage, God sets the gap wider, so much wider, incredibly wider than those obvious sins. The example used here is that of showing partiality. Now, making the choice, we know what that is, making a choice in a social situation to favor one person or one group over another, to show favoritism. This seems pretty small in some ways, doesn't it? I mean, we know it's wrong. We know it's not good behavior. But it doesn't even minutely rise to the level of some of these obvious sinful acts that we often think about. Has anyone ever walked? I should say, has anybody never not walked into a room on some occasion where you had a negative experience with somebody, saw that person and kind of decided, well, today I'm going to steer this way. I'm going to walk to the other side of the room. In the spiritual sense, you're guilty. Partiality. We're guilty of so many small things, and hence the need for God's grace, as we all know. But God sets the bar pretty high, doesn't he? I guess that's the point. He sets the bar pretty high. Small acts matter. Even the smallest of indiscretions, even the things that this world and so many in this world would wink at, God treats seriously. And isn't that really the lesson of so many of the moral failings we read in God's Word. And you think about it. You think about Eve. Would Eve have eaten of the apple had she not made the decision to wander too close to the tree, to take that step? Would Esau sold his birthright had he not given in to, you know, the grumbling of my stomach and made that choice? Had David killed Uriah in the end had he not dwelt too long on the balcony, made that small choice? I consider David's example for a minute. Turn, if you would, over to Psalm 139. You know, they say that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and while it may not be true in every case, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And we've had a lot in the news, you'd probably think ad nauseum in the news recently, about inappropriate acts purported to have, or in some cases even admitted to have, being committed by men in positions of power, various degrees of power, maybe not absolute power, but power. Men who seems, you know, to have thought by virtue of their position that they could get away with taking advantage of those who were less than them, perhaps thinking, it's not a big deal, not a huge issue. After all, look who I am. And David was a man in one of those positions of power, and he knew all too well the impact of small choices, and we know he made mistakes with this. We know all too well, and it had incredibly negative consequences. He knew the power of small choices to undermine the purpose that he'd been called to. And Psalms 139 is thought here to have been written on the occasion of David's taking the throne of Israel. And so it was written before his sin with Bathsheba and the subsequent murder of Uriah, but I'm sure it had to have come to his mind. It had to come to his recollection after those events were passed, this psalm that he had written. I'm sure he reflected on how different things would have been if he had not walked out on the balcony that day. Notice what he writes, Psalm 139:23. Search me, O God. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. And so David knew that the things that could overcome him were things, small things that weren't obvious, small things that maybe lay deep within his heart, that may not have manifested themselves to others. They couldn't see these qualities, these things within him, and maybe they were even hidden to himself. And he asked God that they would be rooted out of him before they would grow, before they would fester into something larger. Rooted out before they could compromise his ability to become and to serve as king. Pretty important stuff, I think, for you and I to consider, isn't it? Future kings and priests in training as we sit here today. Perhaps this should be in our heart as well. Perhaps this should be our prayer. God, you know, make me sensitive to the small things. Forgive me for areas where my pride would tempt me, where I'd be prone to be deceived into an I know better. That doesn't apply to me. Everybody does it. No big deal attitude. It's so prevalent in the world today, and is so prevalently, you know, the message of it's God. Help me to care about the small areas that impact my character, that impact my ability to serve you now in the future. Search my heart and lead me in big ways and in small ways in the way everlasting. So small things, small actions, in a moral sense, do matter. Okay, so Satan tries to deceive us into believing that in the realm of the moral, in the realm of small things, little areas of unfaithfulness, they don't matter. They're no big deal. But he also comes at it from another direction. Small sins don't matter. Don't worry about it. Everybody does it. But your small acts, you know, the little things that you're trying to do for God, the acts of service you're trying to make a contribution in serving the church and doing the work, little acts of faithfulness you're engaging in every day, you know, those small efforts to make a contribution, they don't really matter. They don't really matter. They're not important either. And in so doing, he seeks to discourage us in the small ways, in the small things. I want to share a story with you that I think illustrates this. It was something that came to my mind when I was thinking about these things. When I was a freshman at the Worldwide Church of God's College in Pasadena, California, like most first-year freshmen, I was given a work assignment, and typically those assignments for freshmen coming in were fairly menial jobs, and at least it was a job I considered menial. I had come to college with different ideas about what I wanted to do. I had a love for art. I was an avid drawer. I liked to create beautiful things. At an early age, I'd taken up drawing in my teens. I was given an SLR camera, and I just fell in love with it, and I actually used that to make money as a teenager, doing portraiture in our local church area and some things like that. And so when I was going to go to college, I had this vision that I could take this gift that I felt I was given and be able to serve God's work. And I'm going to bring it all out there, and I'm going to have my equipment. I'm going to go to publishing, and they're going to want to hire me to work, maybe first on the Envoy, maybe on the Portfolio, which was the school newspaper. But eventually, maybe they'll want me for the Worldwide News, or maybe they'll want me for the Good News and, visions. Well, because I wanted to create beauty, and I saw that maybe as God leading me in that direction. I created beauty, all right, if you consider shiny toilets and sinks, clean carpets, a thing of beauty, some people might. My job was in janitorial that first year, and I ended up my nights after the accounting office and publishing had closed, wandering the halls, cleaning, vacuuming, and trying to do that. And I didn't take it that seriously, to be honest. I was discouraged. What does this matter? This is menial. I mean, I brought all this equipment. I can do so much more. And so I really didn't have that serious of an attitude about it. I loathed that job. And I would haphazardly wipe sinks. I would kind of empty the trash and just throw the trash can back wherever. I'd run the vacuum carpet cleaner like a race car driver, not really trying to clean anything, just to kind of say I'd covered it, and get it done. It was just about getting the job done and getting out of there. Well, then one evening something happened that really changed my perspective, and it stayed with me to this day. I was vacuuming under one of the desks in the accounting department, and I'd take the trash can out from a particular cube, I'd empty it, and then for some reason this particular evening, it must have felt like going above and beyond. A piece of trash had fallen that didn't make it into my bigger bin, and it had fallen underneath. I noticed it underneath in the corner of the cube. So I actually got down on my hands and knees and crawled under, and I was grabbing this piece of trash. Well, as I was under there, I backed out, crawled out, and I ran into somebody. And it was a gentleman that worked there, a manager in that area, Fred Stevens. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that name. He was working late that night, at least that's what he told me. I think maybe he was actually staying late on purpose to see what this young kid who was messing up the office, what that was all about, and try to set him straight. But he introduced himself, and he asked where I was from and some other small talk, and then he said something that impacted me and stuck with me all these years. He said, I came over here because I wanted to thank you for the work that you're doing. And I want to let you know how really important, how impactful it is. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Okay, typical first-year response. So, Tony, if I can suggest one thing, I want to show you just how one little detail in the way you do your job every night can make a huge difference to God's work. Okay, sure, all right. He said, take that trash can you just emptied. When you empty that trash can and you take careful thought to make sure all the trash is in the can, and then you take that can, you put it back right where you got it, where you picked it up, it has a huge impact. Oh, really? He said, employees, when they're working, they're going to often go to throw something away. And when they throw it away, they often don't look what they're doing. They're so focused on trying to get their work done. Well, they end up throwing that piece of paper, and it doesn't land in the trash can because the trash can's not where they expected it. So suddenly they're distracted. And if it's under their desk and they decide if it happens more than once, they go out down and try to crawl under there and pick that up. And so they're distracted, and now they're losing productivity and maybe getting frustrated. Well, So, Tony, when you make the point of putting that trash can back in the same place you found it every night, it actually makes this office more productive. It actually makes God's work more productive in small ways. Over time, it makes a huge difference. I know it seems a little thing, he said, but makes a big difference. Taking pride in the details of the job you're doing can have a huge impact on God's work. Do you know what I mean? You know what? I did know what he meant. I got it. I got it. I got the lesson. Don't think of actions, small actions, as trivial. Don't ever think your contribution is unimportant. The things you do, even the seemingly small acts of service you do for God, they have an impact. They matter. Don't despise the day of small things. Turn, if you would, to Zechariah 4, where we'll read that quote. Don't despise the day of small things. Zechariah 4. Zerubbabel. Can't say that. Say that fast five times. Zerubbabel. We read about here in this account. It's ground that I've covered in the past in another message, but I just keep coming back to this in my studies because there's so many rich lessons here to be drawn from this account. Here in Zechariah 4, God, through his prophet, is encouraging Zerubbabel to continue the work of rebuilding the temple. And as you recall, Cyrus, the king of Persia, had given the Jews permission to return to their own land and rebuild the temple that had been destroyed. And as you can imagine, it was an enormous, momentous occasion, accompanied by a great deal of anticipation and excitement. But it was short-lived. There was famine and drought. There was harassment from their enemies. There was no enthusiasm for the project. There were just too many obstacles. But Zerubbabel, certainly discouraged despite these circumstances, despite the support or lack of support from his countrymen that returned with him, he began doing what he was told to do. He took a plumb line. You know what a plumb line is, right? It's got a weight at the end of it, and it's got a string, and he walked to the circumference of the grounds where the temple was out among the ruins, out exposed to the enemy, and he began measuring the width of the temple. And you can imagine some of the thoughts that maybe were going through his mind as he walked among the rubble that once was Solomon's great and grand temple. Oh, this isn't really what I envisioned. I mean, I had visions of enormous, a glorious undertaking returning here to get this built. Feverish outpouring of energy. And now look where I am. I'm standing here with a skeleton crew because no one else wants to come out here. It's dangerous, barely any resources, in danger of attack, in the middle of a field of rubble. I'm holding this line. Measuring a foundation of a temple that's probably never going to be built under these circumstances? How do we get there from here? How small what he was doing must have seemed. How trivial, how unimportant, and how trivial, for that matter, it must have seemed to anybody who was watching him. Do you think Satan may have been speaking to Zerubbabel here, attempting to discourage him? I think so. Speaking into his life thoughts of discouragement and doubt about his value, the value of the work he was doing, his efforts, they're too trivial, they don't mean anything. Notice, though, what God says to the prophet Zechariah here in Zechariah 4, verse 10, because I find this very powerful. Zechariah 4, verse 10, "Who has despised the day of small things? For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth." So here we read of seven. What does the seven refer to? Well, it's a much larger study, but to suffice it to say, the seven eyes referenced here are believed to refer to the seven spirits that we are told in other places are before God's throne. And they, in a sense, act as God's eyes, scanning, as we read here, throughout the whole earth. And God seems to be saying here, you know, I know this isn't what you expected. I know this action you're taking seems small, it seems insignificant, but you're not seeing it the way I see it. Your choice to do this thing in the midst of these circumstances, no matter how small, regardless of how you feel, it speaks volumes to who you are. To who you are. It speaks volumes about your dedication, your faithfulness to me, and this purpose that I've called you to. Don't despise it. Don't diminish it. Because it's not small to me. It's not insignificant. I rejoice to see the plumb line in your hands. Turn, if you would, to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. And I share this story because I think many of us, and I know myself from time to time, can identify with Zerubbabel here. I think Satan, our enemy, sometimes seeks to discourage us like he did Zerubbabel. Again, it's not always in the big things. You know, we often can kind of steel ourselves, our resolve to fight against, to struggle against those big things in life. The big trials hit, and we bolster our spiritual energy, and we lean into them. Satan's not always as effective in those areas with us. Often it's the smaller discouragements. It's the thousand little cuts that we brush away until they seem to pile up in our lives. They seem to overwhelm us and undermine our faith, undermine our spirit. That's where Satan, our enemy, is the master. That's where he thrives. And maybe some of us, when we look at our lives, maybe we had visions of doing something great. Maybe we anticipated more and we think, you know, we've been doing all the right things, but they haven't happened. They haven't panned out. Maybe it feels like life's passing us by and we've done nothing of importance with the years we've been given. We have nothing, no great gifts, nothing great to contribute. Not being used, not worthwhile, not contributing, and maybe a little discouraged. That's not the way God would have us feel. And it's here in 1 Corinthians 15:58 where we read of our hope in the resurrection and the life to come that I think the sentiment here should inform how we should view our efforts at faithfulness in this life as we look forward to then. It says 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. Verse 58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast. Stay at it. Be immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Be steadfast. Be unmovable. Abound in the work of the Lord. Whatever form that work takes, no matter how small, no matter how insignificant your actions or your contribution might seem in your eyes, they're not in God's. You know, the value that God places on small acts of service to him are everywhere, are attested to everywhere in this book. It's in Jesus' parable of the unjust steward, where we're told that he who is faithful, as I said, in little will be faithful in much. It's in the story of the widow's mite. It's in the parable of the talents, where the one who was given the least to invest was rejected, and because rather than invest that small amount, he buried it in the sand. Small is important. It's Ecclesiastes 9:10, which instructs us, whatever your hand finds to do, no matter how small, do it with all your might. In Matthew 13, Jesus says, the kingdom is like a grain of a mustard seed. You know, it starts small. It starts small, barely perceptible. It's placed in the soil. But there's things happening that are often unseen, unknown by others. Minute changes are occurring that ultimately burst forth and will burst forth in amazing growth and be seen. I used to sing a song to Courtney when she was a little girl. I didn't sing to Jordan. He didn't go for that kind of thing. We wrestled usually. But Courtney, I sang a song to usually the same song, I sang this song called The Rose, if you're familiar with that. I won't sing it if you're not. Some say love, it is a flat river. You know, you may have heard that Bette Midler sing that song. So I'd sing this song to her, except, well, because, you know, I'm a dad, and dads are silly, I would change words. So instead of saying the rose, I'd say like the rutabaga or something like that, corny. But the last part of that song I think is really powerful, and it was a message I always hoped would not be lost on my daughter. The last part goes like this. It goes, when the night has been too lonely and the road has been too long and you think that love is only for the lucky and the strong, just remember in the winter far beneath the bitter snows lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rutabaga. You know, through the silliness, I'd hope that the message came through to her that there's so many great things in life The realization of God's purpose for her, the things she hoped for in life, the things that really matter, often endure, require enduring some loneliness, often require going down some long roads, suffering through some bitter cold. But when they come, and they will come, in God's timing, in God's design, in His way, they'll be beautiful. They'll be a rose. And that's the message our Heavenly Father had for so many of His servants written in God's Word, who lived and served God in big ways, but so much more often in small. So many ways and small ways that they served them. And that's the message he had for Zerubbabel, and I think it's the message he would have for you and I. The eyes of the Lord look for those who are faithful to obey even in the smallest of ways, whether that's washing dishes in the kitchen after church, in the kitchen, going to the same job day after day that you feel isn't a fit, isn't what you dreamed of week after week, it doesn't fulfill you, but you do it anyway. Whether you sacrifice some goals so that you can tend to the needs of a loved one who needs you, needs your energy, or you're building character. If your life is witnessing to the hope that's within you, you're holding up the plumb line. You're holding up the plumb line. You're laying the foundation, and the eyes of God see your faithfulness, and in that faithfulness our God rejoices. So let's free ourselves from the enemy's attempts to deceive, attempts to discourage. Let's not dismiss the importance of small acts of obedience, because they're the building blocks of character our God is building within us. And let's not despise the day of small things, judging our value, our contribution, our potential, and by the way this world and its God measures, letting Satan succeed in making us feel beaten down, feeling less than, feeling we don't matter. And instead, let's rejoice in how God sees us and them, that in Him we are of inestimable value, that what we do, no matter how small, does matter, that our labor is not in vain in the Lord. And let's be faithful in the small, because the small things matter. He that is faithful in least will be faithful in much. And our God has so much in store for those of us who love Him.